I want to welcome each one of you to Southridge. If this is your first time here, my name is Tim, and we are finishing up during the summertime here. Our pastor, Jeff, he largely focuses on the summer camp that we run here at the church, and he's also doing planning and preparations for the following year for us, so going into the fall into the spring. So he asks a few of us each year, each summer, to come up and give him a spell and provide some of the messages. So this is the last week that you will have guest speakers here. Next week, Jeff will be here and take over. We are starting a new series today, and that series is called Fatal Distractions. There's two places that I really enjoy kind of observing people at. The first one is the airport. In the airport, you can have a bunch of strangers around you, and you get to see people in a way that and act in a way, respond in a way, to some pretty dynamic and changing situations, and you get a real idea of what their character is. The other place that I think it's interesting to observe people is at restaurants. And just a little while ago, I was at a restaurant with my family, and as I was sitting down, I started looking around the restaurant, see who was there, and I looked over, and I particularly saw two families. One family looked over at them, and they were all engaging with each other. They were eating together, having a good time, talking. And then I look over at this other table, and this other family, every single member sitting at the table has their phone out, and they're typing away, chit-chatting, scrolling, slashing, doing whatever it is that they do. And then the father is sitting there, and he's got his elbow on the table, hand on his chin, and he's just got this thousand-yard stare as he's looking out, and nobody at the table is talking with each other. The only times that they put their phones down was when the waitress came, took their order, and then when they ate. And then as soon as they were done eating, everybody was back at the phones. Nobody was talking, nobody was interacting whatsoever. And I find that unusual because when I see people who are going out and they're spending money at a restaurant, typically I think they have a purpose behind what they're doing. So for example, if you are having a dinner party or a birthday party for somebody at a restaurant, typically what you will see is the majority of the people are interacting with one another, they're speaking with one another, they're celebrating the birthday of whoever it is at that table. Or you watch people that are doing business, or having a business lunch or a business dinner. What are they doing? They're interacting with each other. The only time you see them pull a phone out is if they need to reference something for them to continue having a conversation with the person that they're talking with. And then occasionally, what do you see? You'll see a couple at a table, and it's easy to identify whether or not this couple has been together for a while or whether this couple is brand new together. And typically, if they're brand new and they're dating and they're trying to figure each other out and whether or not this is somebody that they want to continue dating, what are they doing? They are interacting with purpose with each other to learn about one another. The only time that you'll see a new couple pick up a phone is when they get that phone call 10 minutes into the call to bail them out just in case things aren't going well. So we're talking today about fatal distractions. And in particular, I want to bring this out. And we're going to kind of use this as one of those things in our lives that is very distracting. And don't get me wrong, there are some great things on this phone. I have maps on here. I have access to information on here. I could take notes and reminders for myself on here. But there are also some terrible things on here that are constantly reminding me or drawing my attention away from what it is that I should be doing at any given particular time. This has killed more callings than persecution ever could. No beheadings, just buzzes. Some of us are trying to hear the voice of God with 17 open apps in our brain and an Alexa in the background. So for those of you that are about my age, maybe a little bit younger, you probably remember a time when you didn't have these phones at your disposal. They weren't with you everywhere you went. When you didn't have computers in your home. And I think most of you who knew that time period would agree that we are more distracted than we were back then. We're definitely more distracted than we were just even 10 years ago. And I'm wondering how many of you would say that you have fewer moments of silence now than ever before. How many of you have checked your phone when you woke up within 10 minutes this morning? And how many of you thought, I should read the Bible, but then something buzzed on here that drew your attention away? How many of you are actually holding your phone or looking at your phone right now? A recent study found that we touch our phones on average of 2,617 times a day. Not pick up, we just reach out, we touch it. This is now a leash to us with notifications. Last week, as I was preparing with Jill for production, she came up back behind the desk there, and I had walked in to the church, and I was like, man, I feel like I am forgetting something. And she opens her purse, and she says, oh, I forgot my phone. We both got up, immediately walked out, had to grab our phones. We were both uncomfortable not having our phones with it. That is the hook that this thing has on our lives right now. But here's the thing about distractions. They're usually not evil. They're just everywhere. And if the enemy can't destroy you, he'll distract you for certain. So I want to be really clear about what this series is about and what it isn't about. This series isn't about those annoying distractions, like the ice machine that stopped working. Or maybe the GFC has popped so many times now that you can't get power out of that plug. Or maybe your puppy who continues to chew on your couch pillows instead of the 30 chew toys that are sitting in an open basket that it has access to. This series is about the fatal distractions, the kinds that pull us away from the deeper calling that God has placed on our life, and the kind that if we're not vigilant are going to lead to our death. So I'm not the only one, right? This isn't just a me problem. This is an us epidemic. We're living in a world where distractions isn't accidental. It is engineered. Every app, every notification, every autoplay video is built to hijack your attention and cash it in for clicks. Silicon Valley has figured out how to monetize your inability to say no. And they're getting filthy rich off of it. We're not just losing time. We're funding an empire with our focus. The longer you scroll, the richer they get, while your calling gathers dust. It's like we're tithing to tech billionaires with our attention spans. We may wonder why we don't feel close to God, but we haven't spent more time with our noses and our but we spent more time in our noses in our phone than we have in the Bible this week. So the enemy doesn't need to destroy our purpose. If he can just keep us distracted from it, I believe he's happy to use the work of a billionaire in a hoodie. MIT's professor of neuroscience, Earl Miller, says, we don't multitask. We task switch. Our brains can't handle two cognitive loads at once. When you think you're multitasking, you're really just doing multiple things poorly. So in so many words, we're not doing more, we're just doing less well. And almost 15 years ago, Linda Stone, a writer and a pioneer internet-focused sociology researcher, was ahead of the curve as she wrote about continuous partial attention. It's the condition of being constantly alert, but to nothing in particular. Always tuned in, but never locked in. That rings with me. My first deployment in Iraq, our squadron commander, we had a mantra in the squadron that when you were getting ready to go out on patrol, people would just start echoing back and forth, get switched on. The idea was that we were going outside of the gate and we are going to a place where people were going to try and kill us. So we better be focused on what our mission is, and we better be ensuring that our weapons and our weapon systems are working appropriately. But here's the cost. Our focus is fractured. Our relationships are thin. Our vision is blurry. Even when we know what matters, we struggle to give it any sustained attention. It's not that we don't have a deeper calling. It's that we're drowning in shallow distractions. So this brings us to someone who had every reason to be distracted. Threats from enemies, criticism from friends, a comfortable job that he could have kept. When the distractions came calling, Nehemiah said something that should be burned into our souls. I'm doing a great work, and I cannot come down. So if you haven't read Nehemiah, Nehemiah is an excellent book about leadership. When you look through it through that lens of somebody who has a purpose and a cause and has to lead people to get to the end state. Nehemiah is not a priest. He's not a prophet. He's a cupbearer. And if you're not sure what a cupbearer is someone that worked for the king and was responsible for anything that the king would drink and ensuring that it was protected and ensuring it wasn't poisoned. So you could say he's got a cushy government job, but that's kind of tongue-in-cheek because assassins are trying to poison food and drinks, and the cupbearer is the one who's supposed to be testing it to ensure that the poison doesn't get to the king. His experience is in tasting wine, not war strategies. But then he hears about the ruins of Jerusalem, and something ignites inside him. The gates were burned, the wall was rubble, but the real ruin? The calling buried inside him that refused to stay quiet. So let's start in Nehemiah 1. Hanani, one of my brothers, came from Judah with some other men, and I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that had survived the exile, and also about Jerusalem. They said to me, "Those who survived the exile are back in the province, are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates have been burned with fire." When I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. So this is when the calling starts for Nehemiah. It's been over 90 years since King Cyrus gave the green light for the Jews who were exiled to return back to Jerusalem. That's multiple generations. That's one person's lifetime. And still the city was in ruins. Why? Well, fear probably played a role. Enemies on every side made rebuilding very dangerous for the Israelites. Bureaucracy didn't help either. Early in Artaxerxes' reign, permission to rebuild had been denied. Honestly, some of it just is misplaced priorities. These people had delayed before. Even rebuilding the temple got put on the back burner for more urgent things. So if they hesitated to rebuild God's house, of course they'd hesitate to rebuild the city. Bottom line, the city had sat in disrepair for decades, and no one had the burden strong enough to change that. Not until Nehemiah heard the news and something deep inside him snapped awake. And keep in mind, Nehemiah probably had never been to Jerusalem. These people weren't evil. They were just distracted. They were scared. They were busy. They were comfortable. Does that sound familiar to any of us here? In that time, walls were important. In Jerusalem, walls represented identity, protection, and presence of God among the nations. This wasn't about infrastructure. This was about covenant witness. Without this witness, I believe, was one of the reasons why Nehemiah grieved. And we say that he grieved. I want you to think about the worst thing that has ever happened in your life, the most sad that you've ever been. That is the depth of grief that Nehemiah was feeling. For Nehemiah, most of us, the call begins not with the voice from heaven, but a burden on the heart. Nehemiah hears the report, and it wrecks him. He weeps, mourns, fast, and praise. And that's where most callings begin. Not with clarity, but with a holy ache. Nehemiah's mourning likely went on for about 4 months. So notice what happens next in Nehemiah 2. In the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, When wine was brought for him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. I had not been sad in the presence before. So the king asked me, "Why does your face look so sad when you are not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart." I was very much afraid, but I said to the king, "May the king live forever. Why should my face not look sad when the city where my ancestors are buried lies in ruins, and its gates have been destroyed by fire?" The king said to me, "What is it that you want?" Then I prayed to God of heaven, and I answered the king, "If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city in Judah where my ancestors are buried, so that I can rebuild it." Nehemiah has been praying, he's been fasting, he's been grieving for months. The calling isn't going away, it is growing, but now it's starting to show on him. And I know that some of you in this room have seen this before. A calling begins to wear on you physically. Nehemiah wasn't tweeting about his burden. He wasn't writing a blog post. He was carrying it inside of him, in his soul, on his face. And that's a big deal, because in ancient courts, sadness wasn't just frowned on. It could cost you your job or it could cost you your life. But Nehemiah couldn't fake it anymore. His calling was starting to leak out of his soul and onto his face. But let's not skip past the fact that Nehemiah is terrified. Stepping into your calling always involves risk. He's scared of losing his job, his access, maybe even his life. And he knows if this moment goes sideways, he may never get another shot. Nehemiah, I believe, as a result in his praying and his fasting, that he uses wisdom and tact in his conversation with the king. He leads with what the king can relate to his ancestors' burial site. In the culture, burial sites were sacred. Even pagan kings respected them. So Nehemiah frames his burden in a way the king can understand. This is divine wisdom. God's confirming Nehemiah's calling through a pagan king, but Nehemiah still has to show up prepared. For Nehemiah and most of us, God confirms our calling through others. When Nehemiah goes before the king, he doesn't get shut down. He gets sent out. Sometimes God uses unexpected people, even pagan kings, to confirm what he's already stirring in us. So don't be surprised if the affirmation of your calling comes through people that you don't expect at all. And some of you, you're on the other side of that equation. You might be the person that God is confirming someone else's calling. So don't withhold your encouragement. Don't sleep on your influence. So about another 2 months pass by, and Nehemiah is in Jerusalem now. He's working on rebuilding the wall. He's bringing together all of the different Israelites who've all got a whole bunch of different agendas. And he's got some opposition from those who do not want the work to be done. When word came to Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem the Arab, and the rest of our enemies that I had rebuilt the wall and not a gap was left in it, though up to that time I had not set the doors in the gates, Sanballat and Geshem sent me this message: "Come, let us meet together in one of the villages on the plain of Ono." But they were scheming to harm me. So I sent messengers to them with this reply: "I am carrying on a great project and cannot go down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and go down to you?" So this is where most of us kind of fall off the wall. The distractions come into play. But distractions don't usually show up waving a red flag. They show up looking reasonable, even urgent sometimes. And Nehemiah knew what was at stake. Nehemiah wasn't just building a wall. He was pushing back against the chaos and reestablishing sacred space. In a world where cosmic powers sought to erase God's people through enemies like Sanballat Tobiah, and Geshem, rebuilding that wall with spiritual warfare. When his enemies invited him to Ono, he refused. The tension for Nehemiah, just like it is for us, if we don't define our great work, someone else is going to define it for us. For Nehemiah and most of us, God fuels our calling with focus. By the time the distractions start flying, Nehemiah is locked in. He's laser focused and he says, I'm doing a great work and I cannot come down. That's what holy discontent does. It locks your feet to the wall and keeps your heart aligned with God's desire for you. If we were to sum up calling, it would be God calls through burden, confirms through people, and sustains through focus. So I'm going to ask you, what's your wall? What's the great work that God has called you to build? And more importantly, what's trying to pull you off of it? What's your distraction? Nehemiah had people, pressure, and threats. We've got pings, posts, and performance reviews. It might look different, but the strategy hasn't changed. Distract the builder, delay the work, dismantle the calling. So I encourage you this week to write this sentence down sometime. I am doing a great work, and I cannot come down from blank. Fill in that blank with whatever God has given you and me. It could be family. It could be healing. It could be calling to lead. It could be an addiction, sobriety, working with students, a role in our church and our community. Put that sentence on your mirror. Put it on your desk. Maybe even put it on your lock screen because the distractions aren't going to stop. And maybe you're not following Jesus right now, but you still feel stuck or aimless or like you've been giving your best energy to things that leave you feeling empty. Could it be that God's inviting you into something deeper? That the restlessness in your soul isn't dysfunction? It's a calling trying to wake you up? If we fast forward from Nehemiah to Ephesians, which is a letter in our New Testament, Paul writes, "We are God's handiwork, created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which God prepared in advance for us to do." In other words, you were not saved from something only. You were saved for something. God does not mass produce people. You are custom built for a calling, and distractions is spiritual vandalism on divine design. You were handcrafted by God for something more than scrolling, comparing, consuming, and regretting. We were made for good works, and they're right in front of you. So we like to finish each one of these messages with some questions for you to think about during the upcoming week and hopefully pray upon. So the first question is, what breaks your heart and keeps you up at night? Again, that's often where the calling starts. What's the great work God's already put in front of you? Is it parenting? Is it serving? Is it mentoring? Reconciling? Starting something new? Restoring something broken? And then finally, what's your plan of Ono? What keeps luring you away from what matters most? Is it busyness, approval, comfort, bitterness, or fear of failure? Thanks again for joining us here today at Southridge. Again, Jeff will be here next week, and I hope that each and every one of you have a blessed week.